Happy Halloween weekend, everyone. I hope you tricked and treated to your heart's content and are ready for midterm elections this week. More and more, the candidates and their teams are using such precise methods to influence our votes. And that has us thinking about the many ways we're manipulated. In Los Angeles, I'm Barbara Bogavin for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of October 31st, 2014. On today's show, Shades of Manipulation. Those political ads that are everywhere, we'll meet one of the people behind them. Also, we explore an app that manipulates the way other people see you. We'll learn how the scent of pumpkin spice beguiles our brains. And we'll hear your stories about how you manipulate yourselves when it comes to your finances. As always, you can visit us online at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. So let's get going. Here's a roundup of your economic week in 20 seconds.
The U.S. economy is up 3.5% in the third quarter, capping the best 6 months in over a decade.
Oil prices plummet, down 25% from the recent peak in June. Why? Demand is slowing in China, and the United States is producing a whole lot of oil.
The U.S. Federal Reserve has officially called time on its stimulus bond buying program.
Well, so much happening this weekend that directly impacts us and our finances. Let's talk about it over brunch. Virtual brunch in our virtual restaurant. Neil Irwin joins us from Washington, D.C. He's a senior economic correspondent at The Upshot for The New York Times. And Shannon Bond has graciously brought bagels because she's in New York, where she's media correspondent for The Financial Times. And thank you so much, Shannon. There was no way I was going to get decent bagels in L.A.
Well, you just don't have the water for it.
That's exactly right. Not bad enough, I think. Nice of you to drop by, Neil, too.
Thanks for having me.
Shannon, I do want to talk about the midterms, where they're going with the issue of raising the minimum wage and their ballot initiatives in five states proposing a raise, right?
Yeah, it's you're finally seeing some momentum on a topic that has been kind of bubbling up for a while. I mean, we've seen some regional moves this way. SeaTac in Washington has passed a minimum wage, I think, of $15, and Seattle is also phasing one in. But this is, you know, this is something. On the one hand, it's a good move for Democrats to try to get to increase turnout during this election, especially without a presidential name on the ballot to get more people out. But there's still a lot of questions. It seems, I mean, Neil probably knows a bit more about this than me, but there's a lot of disagreement, as I understand it, among economists over really what the impact of raising minimum wage is.
Yeah, Neil, is there any consensus? Because I understand economists are divided on whether it's a good thing and how it affects employment.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing because what everybody agrees on is that at some point, if you raise the minimum wage too high, what's going to result is fewer jobs for low-wage workers. If you say, oh, everybody should make $20 an hour or $30 an hour, you know what's going to happen. Companies are going to shut down if they can't afford that kind of wages. They might replace workers with machines. But the question is, where's that sweet spot where you can raise the minimum wage a little bit and create better working conditions for lower-income workers but not have such a big effect that you're really going to cause a loss of jobs?
And is this thinking really evidence-based, scientific? I mean, what are the statistics on that? Do we lose jobs when wages go up? And we're not talking about huge raises to the minimum wage in many of the states.
Yeah, there's been a lot of economists doing a lot of work on this over the years. You know, you have situations where, you know, one state raises the minimum wage and the state next door doesn't. So you can kind of compare what happens to different companies and wages and job creation in those two states. And I think the consensus is that these small, modest, you know, $1-$2 increases in the minimum wage don't have a tremendously significant downward effect on jobs. So it looks like there is room, by a lot of the evidence, to raise the minimum wage at least a little bit and achieve that sweet spot. Question is where that magic sweet spot might be.
Yeah, and you talk to anybody who's trying to live on some of these salaries, and they'll tell you though how much of a difference it makes to their lives. I mean, it really is almost immeasurable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're seeing a lot of people. You know, we're talking about how there is a bit of a pickup in growth. I mean, we got good GDP numbers this morning. But you know, I think for most Americans, there's a big disconnect from the headlines they see about what's happening in the economy and what they actually see happening in their bank accounts. And so these kind of moves like could be a boost, particularly for those lowest paid workers. A lot of them are female. A lot of them are single parents, and you know, that can make a big difference for their monthly expenses.
You know, changing the topic a bit, but thinking about the election, it reminded me It did remind me of a Halloween story. Did you hear about how Republicans and Democrats aren't afraid of the same things? They're afraid of very different things.
Well, and it seemed like actually Republicans weren't afraid of anything as much as Democrats were. I'm not quite sure what that says.
Well, that's misleading, though, don't you think? Neil, did you see this? Apparently, Democrats are more than twice as likely to be terrified of clowns. And here I thought everybody was afraid of clowns.
I think the real question, did they survey, though, for Ebola and ISIS? Those are the hot fears of the moment.
Right. I know they did seem a little Halloween obsessed because they were asking about things like bugs, snakes and animals, also blood and needles. And apparently Democrats are more likely to be afraid of those Halloween-y things.
But and everyone study, is more afraid of zombies, I think.
Well, that's right.
The upshot of that.
Although this study just seems to make Democrats out to be wusses.
Might be a clever bit of campaigning just ahead of the election.
You know what I'm afraid of?
Ominous.
Yes. Yes, clowns.
No, not everybody.
What
they're
I'm
terrifying.
Really afraid of is that the recovery we seem to be seeing in the economy is a blip. And you just mentioned, Shannon, a little earlier, the new GDP numbers. You know, things went well this summer, but does it really add up to true growth in jobs or housing? What do you guys think?
Well, you didn't see a lot of consumer spending in this GDP figure. You didn't see sort of the stronger levels we were seeing in the summer, and in some of the, you know, there you certainly haven't seen a pickup in housing. And you know, those are the two things that, you know, economists and certainly the Fed are looking at to really be able to say, you know, we're back on track for better growth.
The basic story this last 5 years, it's been amazingly consistent the last 5 years. Growth has been steady. The overall economy keeps growing year after year, 2-3%, where exactly it settles is anybody's guess, but that's consistent. What hasn't been happening is wages have not been rising, especially for middle-income Americans. So, you know, if you look at inflation, you know, if you look at the wage data, it's up 2% or something, but inflation is around 2%. So basically, what's happening is middle-income Americans are not seeing raises in any real way, in any real improvement in their standard of living. And, you know, you ask, why are people so unhappy with the economy, even though we've had, you know, 5 straight years of growth? I think it's a pretty simple answer, and that's the nut of it.
Yeah, and a lot of this GDP growth was in exports, but the dollar's getting stronger, right? American products get more expensive for foreign markets. That trend can't continue. And please help yourself to my California almonds.
Right. You know, we keep seeing these numbers, and you know, what we try and do is pick apart what are the internal details of these numbers tell us. And this is exactly what you say. So we had a good headline number, 3.5% growth in the third quarter. Oh, great. That sounds fantastic. But the more you look at the details, the more it's things that don't tend to repeat themselves. You know, it's things like net exports, as you say. It's government spending. It's things that we can't really count on to signal there's a robust private sector recovery going on. It's still more of this muddling along that we've had for 5 years.
Neil Irwin with the upshot at the New York Times, Financial Times media correspondent Shannon Bond. I hope you guys have a great weekend, both of you.
You too.
I need to refill my coffee.
Well, we're just days away from midterm elections, and depending on where you live, you might be getting bombarded by political ads on TV and radio. Well, now here's your chance to meet one of the people behind the curtain. Jeff Truman runs a company called High Gravity Sounds. He works with producers and post-production houses to create custom sound design. This time of year, he's busy producing music for campaign ads. His mission, to make you feel something.
Political campaigns are a quick turnaround. It's one where you need to be very clear about what the emotional backdrop is going to be, and you don't want to get in the way of what the message is going to be. You just want to effectively paint the picture so that the story can be told. There's some pretty tried and true themes: patriotism, suspicion, pride. There's also this blend at times where you will hear the setup of candidate A, who is not to be trusted, and then the second half of the message is turning that around to show how candidate B is to be trusted. So trust and mistrust are big themes. With music, you can go to certain colors. Certain instruments, certain rhythms, certain sort of templates that have been used for centuries in order to paint a picture of something that's dark and foreboding and complicated, and then sometimes just turn it on its ear in a relative way, and all of a sudden you've got something clear and inspiring and hopeful. And I mean that quite literally. I mean, there are relative keys that you use for that effect. Well, suspicion sounds can be accomplished with strings in the upper register, can be accomplished with some electronic sounds that aren't, you don't want to go for anything terribly disjointed or that's grating or something that's going to create some tension. And that can also be done with percussion. You have to kind of understand, too, that the lighter the touch, the better. So if you can create that mistrust with a couple of different instruments that are a little dissonant, that might be just enough dissonant to create some mistrust and some questioning, that's a good thing. I feel like I have little kids that sort of go off and do their thing. It sounds silly, but you create something. You spend a lot of time in a short period of time with it. And I'd be lying if I said I wasn't proud of, you know, this track and that track. And the funny thing is that when you listen to it again a year or two later, there's a lot of different things you might try to do differently just because you've been around it for a while and you think about things differently. And it's not to say that I dislike it necessarily, but I might tweak this or tweak that. But generally speaking, I'm pretty happy with the stuff that I do. Next time you watch a commercial or you play a video game, understand that there are people slaving away, working hard to make that thing work.
Jeff Truman of High Gravity Sounds. And there's more Marketplace Weekend coming up in just a moment. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
This prototype, this is a snap-on wristband that do biometric readings. Awesome. But when I unsnap it, it becomes a stylus. Fabulous. I could take this device off, twist it, becomes a ring, put it on my finger, and has an LED screen.
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He's our guide to tech in real life. And hey, Ben.
Hey, Barbara. How are you?
I'm great. It's so nice to talk with you again.
Likewise.
And I have a question because we're going to be talking about some photo shopping apps. And my question for you, I'm thinking you're Mr. Technology. So you probably do a lot of texting with your friends and you're interacting with them in text and on Tumblr and on Facebook, just like my kids, right? Do you actually pick up a phone these days to talk to people?
You know, I have to admit, I'm a little old school. I like to talk to people on the phone. But I will also say that I just did a Google Hangout with my mom last night.
Oh, look at you jump back.
Yeah.
And your mom.
She's pretty good. She's pretty good. And I was putting glasses on her and feathers and, you know, altering my own appearance, which is something that's really interesting that you can do in this video chat Google Hangout universe. You can add stuff to your face. And I think that's really interesting. But there's a whole new layer of this as it relates to teenagers, right?
You talked to Dana Boyd, and I've also interviewed Dana Boyd, the author of that book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. And she writes about how more and more, not only is this interaction not happening face-to-face with teenagers, but it has something to do with parents overscheduling them. She kind of puts the blame on parents that they don't really have the freedom and time to hang out because they have so much they have to do. And that's not really my experience. I think it's just the culture. I think that's the way our lives are going.
Well, you know that song, Parents Just Don't Understand. I mean, I think that's probably accurate.
And their selfies and their profile photos, those are who they are. That is their identity.
Yes,
it's serious stuff.
You are your avatar. And so there's been this huge rise, right, in these apps that sort of Photoshop or alter your appearance in photos. Video has always been, or it hasn't always been, but it has often been evidence of real life. Right? It's been this way to tell, oh, this really happened. It holds up in court.
Yeah.
It is a document.
Now users can edit what they look like in real time, and you can do it in video, right? And that's what this app Luxury gets to. Luxury.
Luxury. Should we try a couple?
Yeah, oh, I cannot wait. Okay, so.
Oh, look at that. Oh, wow. This is terrifying how real time this is. It's like, it's like mapping my face as I move the camera around. And, oh, look, now I'm my head is a burning skull.
Wait, you
Ghost Rider style.
You haven't found the cat app? You can make your head a cat. Cat head.
Oh, my gosh. This is
You know
so
people
weird.
Are going to do that.
This is kind of grumpy cat-ish, and I will definitely do this. I don't feel like this cat.
It's
I don't
not
feel
a
like
friendly
this cat,
cat.
Is no. very. Yeah, it's not.
That's not Maru.
The, it doesn't have my dimples. But this is really fascinating. You're doing the same thing that I'm doing, right? You're pointing this camera at your face,
and you see your face up in the corner, your actual face. But then you have all these filters you can choose, and each one of them changes the main picture. But then the cat is moving her head. Its head, the way I'm moving it, it's so disturbing.
Now I just made myself chubby, and this is.
Oh, I
by
did
the
that.
Way,
it
the
made
name
no
of the
difference.
Filter. It didn't make much difference for me either, to be honest.
It's like instant facelift. In fact, all of this is a little bit like instant facelift.
Apparently, this app doesn't work for live chatting just yet, but you can share the video with your friends. But it would be really interesting to think about the implications of this if you could use it for live chatting with people and you could alter your appearance, right?
Yes. Well, it's a lot like if you ever did Second Life. It's like that.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, I'm a lizard. I look like something out of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And that's what you did on all these game role-playing games. You assume an avatar, and then you interact with your friends. So it's very similar to that, except it does take it to that next level, which is your video chatting with your friend in another country.
Well, here's who,
could
speaking
get very
of your
freaky
friends,
very fast.
Speaking of your friends in another country, Luxury says it's also hoping to sign deals with call centers, mobile carriers, and cosmetics companies to license this technology. So take it to that next level. The CEO says that some people don't take kindly to customer support calls outsourced to India or Bangladesh, but he suggests the technology could make a poor call center employee look like beautiful women.
Wait a second.
Yes.
Wow. Now that is offensive and upsetting on so many levels. I don't know where to start.
This is a problem generally with media, right? Is that we put together this idea of the most beautiful, the most perfect person, and then in whatever we create and companies that want us to buy their products, right, endeavor to present that image to us as we interact with the company. And this is sort of what we're talking about, but at a whole new level.
It's so demeaning to the people who work there, to the people, to us as customers, that we only accept people who look perfect. That's all we
concerning.
Want. I mean, I'm just speechless. So I think we're going to have to leave it there so that I can fume for the rest of the day.
Well, maybe you could fume as the burning skull person. I don't know. That's at least we could fume.
I can't tear myself away from the lizard head. So that might work. Wonderful to talk with you as always. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks a lot for this.
Thank you, Barbara.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app from the iTunes Store or Google Play. You know, I wonder what it will be like when we're all wearing Google Glass or some kind of virtual reality headgear. And all we see are each other's perfectly enhanced avatars in real life. Well, my next guest, he doesn't have an answer to that, but he does have answers to some similar questions. He is Marketplace producer Tommy Andres, and not too long ago, he started a segment on Kai's show called I've Always Wondered. It is just really fun radio, and it's so nice to have you on our weekend show, Tommy.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Okay, so what's the concept?
You know, there's these questions out there that still exist. We all have smartphones, everyone can Google, but there are questions that you still can't find on Google. They're usually these little nagging questions that bug you the most. And we decided to tackle some of those for our listeners. We've been doing this about 8 months or so we've been getting some pretty great questions. And I want to ask you a question that may sound a little personal, but what shape is your butter, Barbara?
Is that a euphemism?
It is not. I'm actually asking you because we got this question from a listener.
This is Bonnie Robinson Beck from Larchmont, New York. And I've always wondered why butter cubes are long and thin in the east and short and squat in the west. Where did the two sizes meet and why did this come about?
I never even noticed that.
Yeah, this is really weird. I didn't even know about this until Bonnie's question. I mean, it's something that never really crossed my mind. But it's true. Every butter stick you pick up in Los Angeles, in Southern California, she's up in San Francisco, that's true. They're these short, squatty ones. What I've learned from this series is that there is literally an expert for everything. The University of California, Davis actually used to have a dairy research and information center. And I say used to have because it was basically one guy and now he's retired. His name is John Brune, and I called him up.
In the early 1960s, the West was deficit in terms of milk production to make all these dairy byproducts like cheeses and butter in particular. All our milk went to the fluid needs, whole milk, low-fat milks, and non-fat milks, for example.
So he's saying our milk as a Californian, of course. And basically, there was enough milk to drink, but that was about it. But that changed quickly. In fact, California was on its way to becoming the number one dairy-producing state.
Up until that time, we relied on the rest of the country to supply us our butter. But we were able to become self-sufficient in butter production eventually, as did other parts of the West.
So that started in like the 1960s. And because the butter industry started so much earlier in the East than it did in the West.
The size of the cube you see in the West is the result of probably newer equipment purchased at the time to package the butter. Whereas those in the Midwest and other parts of the country where butter was being produced and had been produced for a very long time were using what they started out with.
So they have newer equipment in the West because the butter industry started so much later there. So I learned not just about that, but about packaging butter. Like, why is it in sticks in the first place, right?
You are unstoppable.
You got to wonder these little things, right?
This rabbit hole you have found.
That's right. These are the rabbit holes. And are you ready for the long and skinny on this?
I think so. Yeah,
okay.
Hit me.
So the reason so many things in the grocery store come in a sealed bag inside of a cardboard carton, you know, like cookies and crackers and all that stuff. This one guy named Frank Peters created this design for a brand of crackers called Unitas back in 1889, and it was revolutionary. It kept the crackers fresh. It stopped them from breaking. Like everyone else, the butter industry thought the idea was great. You know, they're looking at these packages and going, hey, this might work for us too. Plus, customers could now tell how much they were getting because it's like, oh, here's an exact amount, right? It's not just like this ball of butter and cloth that supposedly is a pound. So butter was sold in pounds. So they designed a box that basically was a one-pound box, a square, and they put the butter in.
Well, that all sounds great. I don't know where the sticks come in, though.
That's right. We haven't gotten to the sticks yet, so I'm glad you asked that. Let's keep going down that spiral, Barbara. So a guy who owned a restaurant in New Orleans wrote a letter to a butter supplier named Swift & Company in Hutchinson, Kansas, and he asked if he could get his one-pound block of butter that now came in this box in quarter-pound sticks. Now, he was a big buyer. A big guy. So the idea actually caught on. The company was like, hey, this is actually a pretty good idea. So they started making it and it spread.
Huh. So it's pretty much the law of the marketplace.
Pretty much the law of the marketplace. That's right. These two guys were very influential in the butter we use today.
I think it's great. I really enjoyed the segment and it's loads of fun talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Tommy Andres, he's a marketplace producer. He produces the I've Always Wondered segment on that show. And you can log on to marketplace.org and click on this little vintage brain graphic in the middle of the page that says, I've Always Wondered, if you'd like to ask a question. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Lizzie O'Leary. Well, whatever the outcome of the midterms, President Obama will likely use the next 2 years to move forward on some of his remaining campaign promises, and one of them is to close the digital divide in this country. Back in 2010, he unveiled a national plan to give, quote, every American affordable access to robust broadband by 2020. But according to new analysis of broadband data by the Financial Times, that target date might have to be pushed back, way back. David Crow is the New York correspondent for the Financial Times, and he joins us now to explain why. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Barbara.
Well, the headline for your study is that the digital divide is exacerbating income inequality in this country, not just mirroring it. So what do you mean by that?
Well, Barbara, it's easy to forget just how much of our lives that we live online now. If you don't have an internet connection, you can't apply for jobs. You can't apply for funding towards your education. You can't access the learning materials that your teacher might put online. And you can't search for the best prices on clothes and home appliances. You can't access the online health services that are at the centre of the Affordable Health Care Act. And so what this does is it exacerbates the poverty trap.
So you have crunched the numbers on who has access to broadband in the U.S., and the disparities sound really stark. Could you paint the picture for us?
Okay, so there's about 31 million households without broadband access in the U.S., mostly households with poor families or certain racial groups, people who live in rural areas and the old and the disabled.
Well, that is the conventional wisdom, or it was anyway, that people who live in urban areas are more likely to have broadband, while people in rural areas often had no access. But you found that not to be the case necessarily.
Well, that's the really interesting thing about what we found, Barbara. We were of the view, like everyone else, that this was predominantly a problem caused by the rural geography of the U.S., And that is a factor. About 67% of households in rural areas have broadband, and about 75% of urban households have it. But our analysis showed that the problem was just as acute in some urban areas, places like Detroit and Flint in Michigan and Macon in Georgia, where the broadband subscription rate is below 50%. And there's a huge disparity between those urban places and the top towns and cities, where the rate is about 95%.
Wow. So does it all come down to household income or the robustness of the city that you live in?
There are a number of factors. I mean, the main one is income. Just 45% of households earning less than $20,000 a year have broadband, whereas the rate for those earning $75,000 or more is 91%. So that is by far and away the major factor. Race is also a big factor. About a third of African-American households have no broadband connection, and that figure is just 20% for white households and 10% for Asian households.
Well, how much does the U.S. stand out among other nations in terms of broadband affordability and access? It sounds like we're doing a really bad job at this compared to the rest of the world.
It does very badly, and especially badly at the affordable end. So the most basic broadband packages, where it's not a huge amount of speed, but it's supposed to be a bit cheaper for poorer families. And so for those packages, you can expect to pay about $44 a month in the US, whereas in the UK, that same package would cost about half that amount, while in South Korea, which is streets ahead of most nations when it comes to the internet, it would be about $16. So in the table compiled by the OECD for this type of internet, the US ranks 30th out of 33 countries for affordability.
And I'm concerned about this promise of basic broadband, because we all know basic broadband could be something that doesn't allow you to compete at all, doesn't really allow you into all of the things that you are said earlier are increasing the digital divide.
Exactly. So basic broadband is sort of speeds of just 2.5 megabits a second. And increasingly, the gold standard is going to be 50 megabits or higher. So it's very, very slow. And again, that sort of prevents you from doing some of the things that the internet has opened up. I mean, if you've got a great idea for a startup and you're in Detroit and you want to start running that from your bedroom, you can forget it if your internet connection is at 2.5 megabits.
And just briefly before we go, when do you think every American would have broadband, robust broadband? If not 2020, when?
I think the date's far, far, far out from that. There's always going to be pockets of the US where it's going to be incredibly difficult. If you live on a ranch in the middle of nowhere, finding a company to lay a cable in the ground for miles and miles just for you is going to be very, very difficult.
David Crow is the New York correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you for taking the time to talk.
Thanks a lot.
More Marketplace Weekend coming up. Stay with us. Last week, we asked you to tell us what you won't give up even when your budgets are tight, and a lot of you got back to us. Nanette Karapetian is a psychotherapist. She's here to analyze what many of you called your guilty pleasures. Nanette, welcome to the show. And to start us off, if you will, what do you think that phrase guilty pleasure really means?
The idea of guilty pleasure is that there are different parts of us. And so that we have a conflicted aspects of ourself. So part of us could feel we really want something so bad and not even sure why, but it makes us feel really good. But at the same time, a different part of us doesn't agree with that and thinks, you know, it's wrong for us for many different reasons. And in this case, potentially, you know, financially harmful.
And I imagine that the guilt also is part of the pleasure in a weird way, right?
Yes.
We feel like we're getting away with something.
That's right. It enhances the pleasure at the same time.
Well, one of our listeners said that no matter how poor she feels, she won't give up her sushi.
Well, it depends. You know, it's all very relative, too. Another part of what guilt implies is that it's inherently harmful in some ways, that you either harm yourself or others. So the idea with sushi, you know, is it such in this case, it was once a month. Is it really harmful to her? Or can it be something she feels good about that she gets to do for herself?
So it does come down to an ROI and a return on investment. And we do have another example, a very simple example, really, of this. And this is from our listener, Tyler Ander. Let's play this clip.
From South Dakota, Sioux Falls. The one thing that I would not give up is actually two things, and that is grass-fed butter and fresh roasted coffee. I think it's absolutely money well spent. While I'm not a biochemist, I have learned that the grass-fed butter is supposed to be healthy for you and a type of energy boost. And so with the coffee that I love and the butter that is delicious with coffee, I find it to be both good for me in terms of my physical health and psychologically. I love it. Makes me happy. I'm curious how a psychologist would go about distinguishing between a good guilty pleasure and a guilty pleasure that it might be good to think about giving up.
Well, there's your question. He also makes a very well-rounded argument, and those aren't very big-ticket items
either. No. And a lot of times people feel guilty about, they think that it's harmful, when in fact it's really not as harmful as they perceive. The idea that they've had from the experiences of their life that they shouldn't have expensive butter or expensive coffee, that somehow they should be more frugal, that that's what's right. And it's not necessarily the case.
It's not these daily cups of coffee, the conventional wisdom that we're going bankrupt because of buying our expensive coffee. That's not what runs up the bills. It's the big ticket items. And if you don't indulge in the little ones, you might really blow your steam on something much more harmful, much more expensive.
Oh, definitely. I find that to be the case quite often. And also with regards to physical health and mental health, too, those also need to be taken in consideration as something that could down the line cost a lot more.
We have an interesting clip now from another listener in which she's addressing this issue, like, when you draw the line, you just cannot give something up, no matter how you figure in the cost-benefit analysis. And this is from Sarah McClure.
From Omaha, Nebraska. The one thing that I don't seem to be able to do without is bird seed, especially in the winter. I can spend up to $30 a week on seed and suet, and I have one of those electric water thingies to keep the birds' water from freezing. Even when I was unemployed and in grad school, the birds ate better than I did. I just figured they kind of relied on me, and watching the birds in the yard kind of gives me a great joy and is a wonderful distraction from anything. You know, I can eat a little more peanut butter and they can have a good time eating their seeds. I guess one could say, why would you suffer when there's absolutely other things that I could have used that money on? But I did it on birdseed.
I saw your eyes get wide when you heard $30 a week on birdseed.
That's very expensive and sad. You know, I hear this case and I feel for this woman because, you know, she clearly has a hard time giving to herself.
You know, do you think so? I was thinking she lives alone. And this might be, I mean, that's what I imagine. She lives alone in these
birds are her family.
She deprives herself. She actually has difficulty with buying food for herself because of this. So it's not something that she is doing for herself in a way that could necessarily be seen as comforting and healthy and fulfilling, because she's taking care of the birds. And yes, that is some that has a sense of fulfillment for her. But also it comes with a sacrifice and a level of deprivation that, you know, in the long run continues and encourages this idea that it's best to give outside of yourself. You have to feel deprived in order to feel like you're giving.
And so that's the conversation you would have with
Sarah. Yeah, with $30 a week for how much I think that bird seeds go, how much they cost is quite a bit. And especially if she has to forego foods that might be good for her.
Nanette Karapetian, she's a psychoanalyst. She's based in Los Feliz. It was such a pleasure to talk with
you.
Thank you for thinking through these questions with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, we just heard some of your stories about the things you won't give up. So in this coming week, let's take it to the next level. We'd love to hear how things that could be considered vices have affected your financial life. Whether it's cigarettes, video games, pot, whatever your predilection, we want to know about it. So go ahead and dish by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org, or you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. This time of year, one guilty pleasure coffee drinkers can't seem to get enough of is the pumpkin spice latte. And speaking of that, have you noticed how we've hit a new pumpkin peak lately? It's invasion of the gourds. Pumpkin products seem to be everywhere.
Pecan pumpkin instant oatmeal, pumpkin bar baking mix, pumpkin pancake and waffle mix.
Jen Carlson is a deputy editor of the New York-based blog Gothamist. She got her pumpkin fix at Trader Joe's.
Pumpkin bagels. Mini ginger pumpkin ice cream mouthfuls.
So how does it happen that all of a sudden one flavor takes over the whole marketplace? For an answer, we turn now to Kantha Schelke. She's a food chemist and principal at a company called Corvus Blue, and it's lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, of course, it is Halloween, and that's become such big business in the last few years that I shouldn't be surprised to see so many pumpkin-flavored products all over the place. But this year seems extreme. Why are we seeing so many pumpkin-y things?
So the very mention of the word, and definitely a sniff of the aroma, takes one back immediately to the holidays, to family gatherings, to laughter, to gathering around a fire, and of course the taste of pumpkin pie, which a lot of people in the Western culture really like and associate with the holidays. And that, I think, has slowly grown so much so that this spice flavoring has pervaded practically every category.
Interesting. One more thing we can blame on Starbucks. But is it also about the primacy of smell among our senses and perhaps at this time of year, as the weather gets colder?
You're absolutely right. The spices and the aroma that these spices give in pumpkin spice are very comforting. The cinnamon, the ginger, the nutmeg. They're very comforting, they're very soothing, they're very warming, and I think that's why people reach out to them.
Well, what about the marketing angle? Why are we seeing so much pumpkin right now?
Pumpkin spice flavoring is an affordable pleasure. Anybody can have it. And it takes you back to the holidays, and you don't have to travel anywhere. You can sit at your desk and go somewhere instantly. And I think that is something that no other food can give us today. And that is why pumpkin spice latte is so popular in the Western world.
I'm thinking also that it's all about snack food right now. Is that correct from a marketing point of view? And pumpkin is riding that wave?
Now, snacking, which is definitely an American phenomenon, has been growing in leaps and bounds, so much so that it's called the fifth meal.
Oh, and, no, there, you said everything that's wrong about American eating habits right there.
Well, this is what we do. We love to eat. So this is the fifth meal. And people are fighting with each other, manufacturers and brands and everyone who's got a place in the snack aisle. wants you to come in there, and anybody who serves a snack wants you to come in.
Yeah, and I guess you do get that frisson of adventure, you know, when you try a coffee flavored potato chip, which I gather exists. I've seen that.
You are absolutely right. And yes, we are becoming more adventurous because food companies have done a tremendous job of delivering exactly the very same notes. If you closed your eyes, you would actually think there was a pumpkin pie baking right next to you. We couldn't do that a few years ago. We can do that today. That's what makes it even more interesting. And people are confident. They know it'll deliver on the promise that of pumpkin pie, and so they go for it.
Well, can you give us a window into this process of developing flavors? How do companies research when they want the next pumpkin?
They look at a number of things. First of all, they look at where are people getting their flavor cues from today. And I can tell you that 10 years ago versus today, there's a big difference. We've become so global. We travel a lot. And we've had a taste of different foods, different ethnic flavors. And we're coming back with that lingering taste, and we want more and more of it. So it's easier now to introduce some of these exotic flavors, which would have been rather difficult a few years ago.
Well, what is the big new thing, the new hotness? What do you expect to take off?
I think we're going to see more peppers, because while people get used to this nice pumpkin pie spice or pumpkin spice flavoring, they now want a small kick to it. And that kick can come from peppers. And peppers are growing in leaps and bounds. People like peppers. People think that the capsaicin, the heat in the pepper, is good for them. It's a great experience. You're already seeing it in the potato chip aisle. Pepper is showing up in the chai, in the teas, spiced teas. So I imagine that if pumpkin spice flavors last next year, they'll probably be spiked with a little bit of pepper, but then the peppers are going to take over.
Do you like pumpkin, Kantha?
I like pumpkin, but pumpkins, and I like pumpkin pie. I also love the aroma of pumpkin pie spice and pumpkin spices. But when it comes to coffee, I'm so puritanical. I like my coffee plain and black.
Kantha Schelke, purist, a food chemist, and she's a principal with Corvus Blue. Such fun talking with you. Thank you for taking the time to talk pumpkin.
Thank you, Barbara. This was so much fun.
Well, what smells and tastes wield a certain power over you? What flavors make you feel something or hold a deeper meaning or memory for you? Let us know. We're on Twitter at Marketplace, WKND, or you can email us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org. Now, as American food manufacturers look to turn up the spice, India already has a long-established tradition of creating tasty heat. From curries and soups to kebabs and rice dishes, spices are an essential part of Indian cooking and life. Our partners at the BBC went behind the scenes of one of India's main manufacturers of spice, a company called MDH. BBC correspondent Yogita Lamai filed this report.
For centuries, spices have brought vivid colors and powerful aromas to India's street markets. And whether it was turmeric or red chilies they were after, shoppers would come to places like this to buy, then grind the spices at home. But with changing lifestyles, most customers, especially in cities, now buy their spices in small packets instead. That's created lots of competition for space on the grocery store shelves. But one brand is perhaps best known across India. MDH was launched in 1948, when Dharampal Gulati moved to Delhi from Pakistan during the partition period. He'd grown up with spices. His father was in the same business back home. Moving to a bigger city brought him more opportunities, but he also needed to change the way he did business.
I was amazed by the beauty and buzz of Delhi when I came here in 1948 from a small town in Pakistan. Therefore, I thought my product should be neatly packed and should look good if they have to be sold in a city like this.
Today, age 92, he still works every day. But he's not just familiar to his staff.
MBH Masale. The customers recognize him too. You'll find his photograph on MDH's spice packets, and he's the face of all its TV adverts. But if the image of the company hasn't changed much, Indian society certainly has. And MDH has done well from those shifting trends, especially around the role of women.
With the changing family structure now, a lot of nuclear families are there, and even the lady of the home is no longer confined to home. They're working, and even if they're not working, they have many other works to do at home, and they have no time to go into the market and buy loose spices, whole spices, and then to grind them at home.
That demand means MDH now has 11 factories here, churning out 35 varieties of spices. And they're not just for Indian customers. It exports to more than 100 countries. But as the scale of the business has increased, so too has its exposure to factors out of its control, especially surging prices.
If you talk about black pepper, a few years back it will be available about 150 rupees a kg. Today, a black pepper is about 700 rupees a kg. If you talk about cumin, if you talk about chilies, if you talk about coriander, the prices have gone up more than double. So our biggest challenge is to keep the price hike minimum, but give the same quality.
Of course, raw material costs apply to everyone in the industry, however they sell their products. And in an Indian market where customers in small towns and rural areas still grind spices at home or buy in loose sachets, there's plenty of space for brands like MDH to sell more.
That story comes to us from our partners at the BBC's India Business Report. You can hear and see more by visiting our website, marketplaceweekend.org. And that'll do it for us for this week. Next week, we'll have some brunch and we'll explore why more and more professional women are freezing their eggs. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Jenny Ament. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Barbara Bogave. Lizzie O'Leary will be back next week. It's been so nice to spend some time with you on the weekend. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great time this weekend. This is APM.